الازداد.
الحكومة الصهيونية الحالية بالتأكيد لا تريد تصعيد حفاظا على.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues. But people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria, headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoud Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its war on terror.
The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nikzad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The Saudi Siege, a War Crime and a Genocide is the title of the seventh official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report highlights the impact of the Saudi blockade on the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech when he said that we will not stand idly by and we will not allow this siege to continue to Saudi Arabia and its allies, that we will use our right to respond. Any country has to protect its citizens. Therefore, I believe that the coming days are fraught with surprises. Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen and prevents the entry of food, medicine, and fuel, and this is genocide.
Officials say the Saudi-led coalition has committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 7 years of war. They also say Riyadh's breach of international law is covered up politically by the United Nations.
We've entered the eighth year. The Saudi-led coalition is still committing war crimes against Yemenis, especially the siege, which takes more lives than airstrikes. Public services, especially the health sector, have been greatly affected by the lack of fuel, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients. Unfortunately, the United Nations provides the political cover-up for the illegal acts of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations describes war-torn Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but has taken no action to end this humanitarian catastrophe.
Observers say Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The Iranian flag was hoisted high in Tehran on a day that's remembered as a milestone in Iran's history. April 1, 1979 was the day when the Islamic Republic replaced 3 millennia of monarchy in Iran. This came in a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots contained yes or no to the Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose to vote yes.
April 1st is the Islamic Republic Day. It was a day when the monarchy gave way to democracy. We as Iranians honor this major occasion and celebrate it every year.
The Islamic Republic blessed Iran with independence and self-reliance. Today, Iran has its own industry and economy, which are not reliant on foreign countries.
The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations. Trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and ill-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment, but because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures.
The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. and leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Afwai. It was a first in Pakistan's history. For the first time, parliamentarians in its parliament chanted death to America. Now, this occurred while there was a no-confidence vote to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan, which was rejected. Why is it that Pakistani lawmakers are saying foreign powers are interfering in the country's democratic process, including the Prime Minister? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this is the case and what Pakistan intends to do about its relation with the U.S. First, let's find out about all the developments that happened. Kamran Yusuf is our correspondent who joins us from Islamabad. Well, there's quite a bit of ground for you to cover for us here. If you can highlight what actually occurred today.
Well, it was quite an unprecedented and a tumultuous day in the history of Pakistan. And the National Assembly of Pakistan was supposed to vote on a no-confidence motion moved by the opposition parties, but the government had other ideas. When the session started, the country's law minister stood up and stated that the speaker should not allow the vote of no confidence take place, since the government believes that this vote of no confidence was part of a foreign conspiracy to topple the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan, since according to the government, he was pursuing an independent foreign policy. And after listening to the law minister's remarks, the deputy speaker of the National Assembly, who happens to be the member of the ruling party, declared that this move by the opposition parties was not in line with the constitution, and hence he dismissed and did not allow opposition to vote on the vote of no confidence, although opposition had the numbers to unseat Prime Minister Imran Khan. And after that, Prime Minister Imran Khan appeared on a national television and congratulated the nation for what he said, defeating the conspiracy hatched by a foreign power. And then he advised the President of Pakistan to dissolve the National Assembly and announce early election. And now the matter is before the Supreme Court of Pakistan because opposition parties have challenged the ruling of the Deputy Speaker because they think that the Speaker had violated the constitutional provisions.
Thank you for that, Kamran Yusuf, correspondent there from Islamabad. We appreciate that. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Liaghat Ali Khan. He's the author, academic, and researcher who joins us from Topeka, Kansas. Also joining us is Shabir Rizvi, managing director of IFSA, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds
to get to the bottom of this story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Lighat Ali Khan, let me first start with you. In your assessment, what occurred in Parliament today was quite unprecedented, just like our correspondent there mentioned. Tell us about some of those developments, what you think it means, especially the fact that at this point we're looking at a Parliament that is dissolved, and then what we're looking at in terms of what the Prime Minister is promoting here.
Yes, thank you. Under the Constitution of Pakistan, when a no-confidence motion is in the National Assembly, the Prime Minister has no constitutional authority to dissolve the Assembly. And the Assembly must vote on the no-confidence motion. So today, on Sunday, this was the last day under the Constitution to vote on the no-confidence motion. But the Prime Minister, he has been arguing that the United States has given money and incentive and help to the opposition parties to overthrow his regime because he has been very close to China and Russia. And I think there is some evidence that the United States is not happy with the Prime Minister, and they won't mind if the Prime Minister is deseated. So to that extent, I think Mr. Khan has a good case. But then he goes further and argues that about 10 political parties, some are very religious parties, some have been anti-American political parties, they all are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. And some 20 members of his own party, so there are like 200 members out of 342 who would like to de-seat the Prime Minister. So I think it's very difficult for people, particularly in the legal community, to accept the assertion that 200 members of the National Assembly and 9 or 10 political parties of Pakistan, they are, they are traitors, the word he uses, and they are trying to overthrow his government because they are conspiring with the United States. So I think what he did is completely, blatantly unconstitutional. And I think the Supreme Court of Pakistan would say so.
So in your opinion, you don't think that what he is claiming is true, the fact that you have all these party members actually cooperating with the U.S.?
I think, I don't know if what he's saying is true or untrue. But that is not the way to resolve the problem.
Sure.
I think if the opposition is actually conspiring with the United States to deceive him, he needs to produce irrebuttable evidence before some court of law to show that that is the case. Mere allegation that 200 members of the National Assembly and mere allegation that 9 political parties are conspiring with the United States to overthrow him, I think that's a big claim.
Right.
And there is no due process to the evidence. There's no due process to the counterclaim of the opposition parties that they are against Prime Minister Khan because his government is incompetent.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
Sure. Let's see what Shabir Rizvi thinks. Shabir Rizvi, we actually have something that's unprecedented, which I'd like to find out from you what you think about it, and that's the fact that you have the chance death to America that happened in Parliament, according to what we have received in reports. And also the fact that the National Assembly Deputy Speaker talking about how no foreign power should be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy. I'm wondering if he's obviously making a reference there to the U.S. And, of course, your thoughts on the chance that were made in Pakistan's parliament.
Hello, thank you very much, Kaveh. It's good to be back, and best wishes in Ramadan for all of us. Now, look, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and I'm not an expert on the intricacies of the political parties in Pakistan. But I think what one has to really understand whether Mr. Imran Khan is using the word conspiracy to strengthen his position or not, we have to look at a bit more in history. The first Prime Minister of Pakistan was assassinated by the CIA back in 1951. And continuously, the USA has interfered in Pakistan. And what one's got to understand is that both the two major parties, the Muslim League and also the Pakistan People's Party, they really have been quite corrupt in the last 30, 40 years in Pakistan. They have, the elite in Pakistan have really impoverished Pakistan, especially the two political dynasties, as I said. So they don't really have a very good record. And I really like to sort of put this in the mix for Pakistani elite who have investments in UK and USA. You can see that what's happened in the last 4 weeks, that some of the oligarchs' assets have been taken over in UK and their bank accounts have been frozen. I hope the Sharifs and the Zardaris and Mr. Bilawal Bhutto and his sister and Maryam Sharif also should take that into account, that sooner or later their assets will be frozen in UK. So whether they want to be traitors to Pakistan, their livelihood and their assets will be taken over by Britain as soon as they are not in the good books of UK and USA.
Sure.
So, you know, the opposition is playing a very tightrope and delicate game themselves.
Okay, so there you have the view in terms of at least the view from our guest there from London, Lighat Ali Khan, about the opposition. But let's zoom in more on the accusations that has been leveled by Prime Minister Khan against the U.S. Now, based on what we have heard, one of the reasons that he believes the U.S. is behind what has happened in Parliament eventually with the no-confidence motion is because of his visit to Russia last month. Do you find that to be credible?
Yes.
Sorry,
I think the United States does not like that Pakistan, which has been an ally for the United States since its creation in 1947. So I think the United States is not happy, like it is not happy with many other countries that do not agree with the United States. And I think as a superpower, then the superpowers do that, whether it's Russia or China or the United States. They don't like small countries to have independent foreign policy. And I think Pakistan, Prime Minister Khan, he's saying that we want to have an independent foreign policy. Well, that's a very good idea. But the reality is that Pakistan is completely dependent on the West, whether it is the World Bank, whether it's the IMF, whether it is, you know, the defense equipment, in so many ways.
Okay. So let me jump in there. Let me jump in there, Lighat Ali Khan. Ask Kamran Yusuf, Shabir Rizvi, whether he agrees with you on that. Shabir Rizvi, is Pakistan, as much as the Prime Minister wants a foreign policy independent from the U.S. and the West, can it do that? Or based on what our guest said, that that's just really an idea that can't be done?
Look, Pakistan, like many other countries on this planet, have been impoverished by their elite and also by the superpowers. Now, whether Russia, China, or America act similarly, the experience is that since partition, and particularly when Pakistan took the side of USA under the pretext of fighting terrorism 20 years ago under General Musharraf, that clearly shows that Pakistan has come out a loser. So, you know, the Mr. Sharif, who is the main opposition leader at this moment, says that Pakistan is a poor country and poor countries have no rights. I mean, how dare that a particular leader in Pakistan says that poor countries have no rights. Therefore, all poor countries should forget about it. And Iran, next door to Pakistan, is a very good example that for the last 43 years, it had stood up against Iran, against USA.
Right.
And of course, sanctions have blighted the nation. It has created all kinds of problems. But at the end of the day, whether the West dislikes Iran or not, they respect Iran.
Sure.
While Pakistan, because of its own leaders, has no respect in London, Paris, or Washington. And that's what I think Imran Khan and some of the other leaders are trying to sort of get Pakistan to be a respected nation and not to be a vassal of Washington.
Exactly. Yeah, Ali Khan, to break this open more, based again on news that we have, Pakistan's ambassador to Washington actually said that he has recorded a senior U.S. official.
Hello?
This is for Liaghat Ali Khan. Pakistan's ambassador...
Hello, I can't hear you.
...to Washington, who has recorded a senior U.S. official, telling him they felt relations would be better if Khan left office. I mean, that goes beyond...
Yes.
That goes beyond just not having a country aligned with your foreign policy, in the case of the U.S., to want Khan to leave office. Again, if this is true, which we believe that it is, do you think that that is the way U.S. approaches it? Their track record speaks as such.
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. All superpowers and even middle powers, they want to influence other nations. Actually, let me say it to you. Not even the United States, the superpower, can pursue an independent foreign policy. This whole concept of independent foreign policy is passé. It's not valid. I think the nations are so mutually dependent that no country, no matter how strong, can pursue an independent foreign policy. So as a smart nation, not a foolish nation, as a smart nation, you have to see the enmeshment of the world. You have to understand that the world is no longer not united. It is united, sometimes in a pathological way, that we are dependent on each other, and there's hierarchy in the international community. So I think as a smart nation, you don't defy superpowers. You work with them, mm-hmm. and you make your case without destroying yourself. I think Saddam Hussein did that. Mr. Gaddafi did that. I think I would appreciate Iran is very smart. I think they fight in a beautiful way,
right?
In my view, that they resist, but they don't destroy their nation. And I think Pakistan should do the same.
Well, the problem is who makes a nation a superpower? The definition of that is where I think most of the problem is. So let me get to Shabir Rizvi here. Shabir Rizvi, let's really look at what has happened here when it comes to Imran Khan vis-a-vis the U.S. One of the problems that existed between the two, which was very big, was on the issue of Afghanistan. One of the tweets that Khan actually sent out was that to the U.S., said, "The U.S., we will be your friend, not your slave. We will help you withdraw from Afghanistan, but we will not launch military operation for you." That's just one of the stances of Imran Khan. So the U.S. obviously does not particularly care for Khan. Is that a correct conclusion to make on the relationship between Khan and the U.S.?
But look, it's becoming very clear that the direction that Imran Khan wants to take Pakistan, unlike the previous, the two political parties that I talked about, they have really sold their soul very cheaply for their children to be educated in UK and USA and to buy properties in this part of the world. In reality, they've had no love for their nation as such, other than sort of lining their pockets. Coming back to the issue of our friend talking about that no nation has independent policy, yes, I tend to agree with him to a degree. However, independence means that trying to do things that are in the benefit of one's nation and people. Now, if that is a definition of being independent, fine. Otherwise, all nations have to work together. But what we have to really look at is the track record that the USA has in Pakistan and also globally, you know, whether it's sort of color revolutions in Ukraine that happened, as we know, or more recently in Kazakhstan and all over the place. And also assassinations are part of the baggage that USA carries if they do not try to remove a leader by a color revolution or by other conspiratorial methods, then they assassinate. IND is a good example. Lubumbo in Congo is a good example. And I can go on and on and on for another hour listing where USA has assassinated other leaders. China, as far as I know, hasn't done that in the last few years. As right. far as I know, Russia, even in the previous Soviet Union, hasn't done that. So the really...
Okay. These two countries that you mentioned, I'd like to come to Riyad Ali Khan and ask him. Riyad Ali Khan, we're looking at China's relationship with Pakistan. Obviously a very close relationship. The Belt and Road Initiative has given Pakistan quite a bit of investment within the country, which has been ongoing for quite some time. And obviously Pakistan has long enjoyed diplomatic and business relationships with China. Again, multi-billion dollar development deals that they have had. The U.S. obviously does not like that either. So if you put Russia and then put this next to each other, and of course the way that Prime Minister Imran Khan has criticized the U.S. in terms of the way they operated in Afghanistan, and saying that Pakistan could have done more, again, more reason for the U.S. to, according to Imran Khan, want him out?
I think if you want to criticize the United States or any other superpower, you should be an academic. But if you're the prime minister of a country, or if you're the president of a country, then your criticism is within the bounds of pragmatism. Then the interest of your country is superior to the morality of behavior. And I think this is where Mr. Khan, who himself has a very interesting background, he has been a playboy for many decades. And now, you know, he has a tasbih in his hand, and he is now, you know, peddling Islam. And I think he has every right to do so. But as the prime minister of a nuclear-powered country whose economic power is very bad, he has to be pragmatic in his criticism, in his behavior, in his criticism of the United States particularly, mm-hmm. with which Pakistan has the highest international trade. And a lot of money comes from the United States in many forms. So simply from a pragmatic viewpoint, the prime minister cannot challenge the United States. And I think Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, when he detonated the nuclear bombs, President Clinton asked him not to do so. There was a lot of pressure on Nawaz not to detonate nuclear bombs, but he did. And I think at the same time, he was very understanding and very sort of polite to Pakistan, to the United States.
Sure. Well, let's examine the role, if we can here, Shabir Rizvi, of the Pakistani army, and whether there is a stance there that is diverging from the prime minister. Because hours before Prime Minister Khan spoke earlier today, the head of the army, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, had said that Pakistan wanted to expand its ties with Washington. So it seems like they don't want to jeopardize that relationship. Do you think that has to deal with the billions of dollars, maybe in military aid, that the U.S., at least we know, has given Pakistan? Is that what this is about? Or why do you think that Pakistani army is keen on expanding its relation with Washington, diverging from the stance that Imran Khan has?
Well, look, you quite rightly pointed out that the army has a lot of support in Washington and has continued to enjoy armament deals and trade that have benefited the military extremely. However, I think the whole global dynamics in the last 4 weeks has changed so significantly that USA is a declining power, without any doubt. The whole issue of the dollar perhaps not being the reserve currency in the next 5 years or even earlier. And the relationship that is developing between Russia, Iran, and China. And the reality is that Pakistan is in the East. It's not in the West. Yes, it does trade with the West. Yes, it wants to have relationship with the West. But really, the future of Pakistan lies with the East.
I'm sorry, Shabir Rizvi. Lirat Ali Khan, 30 seconds. Where is Pakistan headed to now, given what has occurred? Are we looking at instability in that country? 30 seconds, please.
Yes, I think the Supreme Court would reverse what Imran Khan has done. They would restore the National Assembly, and Mr. Khan would be de-seated from prime ministership.
Okay, thank you. We'll leave it there. Lirat Ali Khan, author, academic, and researcher from Topeka, Kansas. Thank you for your thoughts. Shabir Rizvi, managing director at IFSA London, who spoke to us from London, and at the top of our program, Kamran Yusuf, a correspondent, spoke to us from Islamabad. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tafwi, and the entire team, is goodbye. Until the next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm driving towards the city of Qazvin. Let me turn down the music. It's okay now. Thought you couldn't hear me. I was saying, today we were going to visit an old attractive caravan sarai in Qazvin. Saad al-Saltane Caravan Sarai. Qazvin is one of the central cities of Iran. This city is located 153 kilometers from Tehran. Qazvin was the capital city of Iran for 57 years during the Safavid era. That is why this city has many historical monuments. Saad al-Saltane Caravan Sarai is one of these historical monuments. This caravan sarai was built in Qajarid era at the time of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. Saad al-Saltane Caravan Sarai is the largest in-town roofed caravan sarai of Iran. The reconstruction of this caravan sarai took 20 years, and some parts of it are still being reconstructed. Saad al-Saltane Caravan Sarai has four semi-domes. Unlike other roofed caravan sarais, its ceilings doesn't have any light well. The architecture of this unique historical monument has an introvert character. This caravan sarai has six interconnected sara, including Sa'diye, Saad al-Saltane, Negar al-Saltane, Qahramani, Beheshti, and Rasteye Vazir. A saro is an Iranian traditional structure including both indoor and outdoor sections. Normally, all the rooms are around facing the courtyard. These saros are brick-made and have great Iranian architecture. I am now at the entrance corridor of the caravansarai. This corridor has several brick-made vaults. It's fantastic. The bricks are beautifully decorated. From this point, I can't see the courtyard. I always wanted to see this magnificent historical building. Happy to see it today. The Sultane Caravansarai has 7 courtyards, and I am now in one of these courtyards. Very pretty. This courtyard is surrounded by some chambers. Oh, look! There is a very beautiful statue in the middle of the courtyard. The statue of a man riding on a camel, staring at an uncertain point in the sky. He seems to be a merchant of the Qajar dynasty. I guessed it from his outfit. And I am now in the most valuable part of the building, which is called Chahar Sogh. For your information, Chahar Sogh is an area which is said to have a quadrilateral space that can be indoors or open. And just above my head, there is a large dome decorated by tiles. It's gorgeous. The blue and turquoise tiles remind me of the sky. Our Iranian architecture is full of wonders and beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.